Accession number 27210, Reel 2.
You tell me to start.
Yes, Lord Healy, please, yes, continue. We were talking about Dieppe.
Yes, that's right. The first seaborne landing we did was at Dieppe, which fortunately I didn't take part in, and that was a disaster because we hadn't bothered to get intelligence, which any tourist could have given us, that there was a long 6 foot deep shingle beach which the tanks couldn't possibly cross, and then at the end of it there was a 10 foot concrete wall which they couldn't get up. So of course the tanks were all stuck on the beach, and then the Germans were able to destroy them by continuous artillery fire. So what we learned, you must get careful intelligence, make sure you get a beach you can cross, and then when you get there, if it's shingle, you have to put metal carpets on, you have to sweep it for mines, and of course the Germans mine pretty well all the beaches in Italy. And you must have control of the air, or you haven't a chance of succeeding.
Did you have control of the air in your first Italian, mainland Italian?
No, the Calabria we didn't, because we hadn't. Our aircraft were too far away. The base for them was way down in Sicily, and the result was that the Germans could dive bomb us there, which is quite a frightening experience, being dive bombed. You know, you hear the thing coming straight above you out of the sun and then dropping its bombs, but I survived it. The only wound I got in the war was a broken tooth when my lorry ran into
concrete post.
Exactly, yes. On the road to Castellammare, loading up for Anzio.
Yes, and you described in your book that the subsequent dental treatment was more painful than anything else you
yes, it was,
suffered.
Absolutely, the bastard. Yes, he was army dentist.
Worse than the Germans. So you were on the beach only for a day and a half. And
yes.
Can you then, at the first landing, at the first mainland Italian landing, can you then just tell me what you then did? What are your tasks?
When there wasn't a landing, I did. I really was responsible for the ports through which we landed. You know, our troops and ammunition and guns and tanks. And I was at Bari and Taranto, in the heel of Italy, and then went up to Foggia, but then I was told we were going to land at Anzio. At that time we were stuck at Cassino, we couldn't get beyond Cassino, the Germans had total control of the area, and
that must have been a big secret that the landing was going to take place at Anzio, so only a very limited number of people knew.
Yeah, we had total security there. And it was, I mean, we lost fewer men on the landing itself than the Germans lost on the exercise for the landing. The only people we lost, in fact, were in a duck where they hadn't got the water pump working properly, and so a couple of men were drowned. But, I was only again there for the landing. I left after 3 days, and it was a piece of cake. We captured two German officers in their pyjamas in a cottage, a few hundred yards from the beach. But then we were held in, our troops, but it turned out to be a strategic success because the Germans sent divisions down from France and Central Europe down to hold us in at Anzio, and so it turned out to be strategically quite a success because we took so many German troops away.
Yes. But your participation in that landing was only 3 days.
That's right, yes, because my job was simply landing, getting people on and off the beach, and once I'd done that, I went back to base, maybe do another landing, sometimes very soon, but in fact it was the last landing I did. I was trained to do a landing. We were going to do one on the island of Kirk, which was just before Trieste off the Istrian peninsula, but and that would have been a disaster because the Germans had got a lot of mortars and guns on the top of the island and facing, and we'd have been worse than a landing in Santa Clara, but fortunately Tito captured Trieste, and so the Germans retreated into Austria.
Right. One thing I'd just like to...
Incidentally, I should say the extraordinary thing in the landing at Volta Santa Venere was that while we were actually at sea, and we had a wireless, of course, on our landing craft, we heard that the Italians had surrendered. Made no difference to us, of course.
No, because the Germans are the main enemy. I just want to come back. During your... in between these landings, you spent some time, obviously, in southern Italy, and I think you went to the Opera House at Naples, is that
right?
Oh,
yes, that's right. Well, that was when I was actually based in Naples, and my colonel was a man we called Basil the Bastard.
This will be in the winter of 43.
That's right, yes. I had a very, very nice colonel who became a friend for life called Jack Donaldson, who had started the Peckham Health Centre before the war, and whose wife, Frankie, was the daughter of the playwright Freddie Lonsdale. And Jack and Frankie became lifelong friends, and he was a good man in every sense of the word or phrase. And when we were based in Naples itself, which was extraordinary mess, because one of our officers who had been worked on the railways in civil life, had a girlfriend who'd been the mistress of Maxim Gorky on Capri in the early 30s, which of course one now realizes was only under 15 years before. But Jack and I, Jack Donaldson, we persuaded the leader of the orchestra at the San Carlo Opera House, Signor Baroni, to form a quartet, and then we organized chamber music concerts for the troops, more or less one a week or one a month, I forget, which were extremely successful.
I just want to ask you, did you meet an officer there at the San Carlo called Peter Francis? Does that name ring any bells at all?
I think I do remember Peter Francis, but I can't remember anything about him. Did you know him?
Yes, at another time, not on this tape, I can tell you about Peter Francis, save that I did interview him, and he arrived there. He was a captain, I think, who was in charge of a radar-controlled anti-aircraft battery.
Oh, yes.
And there weren't many German aircraft around.
Yes.
And he found this opera house at the San Carlo, which had a bomb at the front and a bomb at the back. And he persuaded his brigadier to allow him to repair it because it would be excellent for the troops. And,
absolutely, quite right. Yes.
And in 3 weeks, he put the San Carlo back on its feet.
I think I just remember him, yes. It was wonderful because it was Italy, really, where I'd been to opera in Bradford at the Alhambra and heard Eva Turner sing Turandot there, for example, which she was amazed to hear when I met her again 40 years later. And I saw Anna Pavlova dancing the Flying Swan there too as a boy. But the San Carlo, we held, we got it repaired, Peter Francis did that, and it started performances which went on for the rest of the war, and of course the troops loved it.
Yes.
And I loved it too, and I heard Gigli singing there. Caruso, of course, had gone by that time. And I heard Ebe Stignani, who was the one rival to Callas, singing Norma at a tiny Teatro delle Palme, which was in the hills above Naples, and I think probably only held about 150 people. But that's where my lifelong love for opera really got going, and I was lucky enough, of course, being in Italy, to be able to go to La Fenice in Venice, the Scala in Milan later.
Of course. Mm. And with the fall of Rome, the big stars who were, if you like, imprisoned behind the lines, like Tito Gobbi, they could also...
Yes, that's right. Gobbi.
Gobbi, is that how
you
call
it? Yes, that's right, yes. Who lived at Bassano.
Did he?
Which I used to visit, and met him there, actually. But he did a wonderful Scarpia opposite Callas.
Did he?
Yes.
In Tosca?
Yes. And Il Bacio di Tosca, do you remember? When she stabs him with a dagger.
Yes, the one production, I'll just digress for 1 second, then we'll continue. The one production I've seen is Jonathan Miller's famous fascist Tosca.
Yes.
Which he opened in La Scala about 1980.
Yes.
And I saw that here 10 years later.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that.
Have you not?
No, I admire Miller's productions very much. And although he, you know, did so many of them in modern dress, they were immensely successful the way he did them. I always remember Rigoletto he did.
This one was very dramatic, of course.
Mm.
And very brave to open with a fascist Tosca in La Scala.
Well, what struck me so much about these operas is that Puccini particularly, that Tosca is a story of the resistance in Italy during the war. And Puccini is the romance of European or American soldier with a local girl,
which again was
all over Italy.
Retold a thousand times.
Yes, no, I had a Neapolitan girlfriend, Teresa.
Did you?
That time. Then I got an English Fanny as a girlfriend, who I went to see the other day in Roxburgh.
So you've kept in touch with your girlfriend from 60 years?
Well, Lavinia, yes, she married a regular soldier who died a few years ago. And her children heard that I was coming up to do something at Newcastle and said that Lavinia would love to see me. So I went over to see her, which was very enjoyable.
Good.
Very frail now, of course.
Unfortunately.
Mm.
Yes. So, back to reality, you, Anzio's finished, you left that. What then did you do?
I think I went back to Caserta, to the
headquarters
of Allied Armies Italy, as it was then called. And I did, you know, big planning for movement control. Thing I always remember there is eating a meal and suddenly Humphrey Bogart appearing, because he was doing a concert for the troops somewhere. And he's always been a hero of mine. So I didn't have a chance to talk to him.
What was he like? Did you...
No, I didn't have a chance to talk to him. His wife or girlfriend, partner, Lauren Bacall, Betty Bacall she was called, I met her. We had a wonderful... Two of my best friends were Arthur Schlesinger, the historian, and Ken Galbraith, the economist.
Yes.
And they had the birthdays for the same day, 10 years apart. And we went to their, I went, well, I don't think Edna was there, I went to their birthday party in New York. And Bogart's, Betty Bacall, she was there. And Leonard Bernstein. And he played a little fugue he'd made up called History Economy in their honour. No, it was lovely.
Well, you're at Caserta. Do you feel that you're kicking your heels? There is a feeling, you see, that among some people, the famous song, the D-Day Jodhpur song.
Absolute crap. I mean, honestly, Nancy Astor, anybody who was in that campaign, like Mike Carver, for example, knows it was one of the most bloody in the war, and getting up the spine of Italy, Winston stupidly called it the soft underbelly, but it was a horny spine, and crossing river after river after river with the Germans on the hills on the other side was very, very slow and painful. And of course, Cassino was very, very difficult to take. I became a great friend later of the German general there, who was called Zengerund Etterlin.
How did you meet him?
I met him because he started, he became the second head of, now what was the college called? It was a very progressive sort of university college, Salem, S-A-L-E-M, on the shores of Lake Geneva in Germany. And Kurt Hahn started it, and Zengerund Etterlin became headmaster for a time. And that's when I met him, when he was there. I think I may have met him. No, it must have been. I couldn't have met him during the war. And he became a... Oh, I know, yes, because I met him... No, I met him at the Königswinter conferences. That's right, because he used to go as a German representative. You know, the Anglo-German
yes.
fellowship things. Mm.
Yes. Well, I must ask. This is something I think that you haven't mentioned in your memoir. He was regular Wehrmacht, was he?
Yes, yes.
And he was the casino garrison commander?
Yeah, he was a colonel. No, he was general then, yes. I think he was in charge of the trying to hold the casino, which they did, of course, for a very long time.
Yes.
Because the great mistake we made was, as always, in bombing, when we destroyed the town at the bottom. But, of course, it was the rubble of the destroyed town is perfect as a barrier.
As a defensive.
Because you can put snipers and so on in, and it's very difficult for the attacking forces ever to find them.
Yes. And what was he like as a man?
I liked him very much. A very decent, honourable man. And as I say, he went to this progressive school after the war.
Right. So...
Which, you see, Kurt Hahn later did set up Gordonston.
Of
which
yes.
Prince Philip went to.
Mm. Yes. Yes, and his son with perhaps less success.
Yes. Oh, very much so, yes.
Yes.
And his, oddly enough, the headmaster, the last one I met, was the son of one of my army friends, David Piper. And I met him down here because David retired here. And... his son, who was head of Gordonston when Charles was there, that's right, he used to go to the local shop in Seaford.
You're at Caserta. The point I was going to make, which we've covered about D-Day daughters and Nancy Astor, was that there was a feeling that the Italian campaign was a sideshow. It wasn't the forgotten army, like in Burma, but there was a feeling, I've spoken to people who were there, who felt that they were very much, after D-Day, that they were very much the, you know, the second division.
Oh, very much
outfit.
So, yes. And as you know, they started taking troops, this was one of the mistakes in a way, they started taking troops away from Italy, to part of the landing in southern France and partly to go home for the landing in northern Europe. And with the result that, for example, we never had enough troops when we landed at Anzio to go inland and hold the Colli Laziali, and then we could have prevented the Germans from getting north from Cassino, but we
yes.
never had enough troops for that.
Yes.
Well described by Rollo Trevelyan in his book.
Yes. Yes. You, of course, probably reluctantly were responsible for organising the movement of troops back to
oh,
the UK
course.
And.
Yes. Oh, well, yes. 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 Although that. Oh, yes. During the war.
Yes.
I suppose so, yes. From Naples they would mainly go, I think, at that time. But we were always short, and of course the Germans ran the campaign very well. First of all, they had the Gustav Line and then the Gothic Line, which we found it quite impossible to penetrate until the Germans surrendered on May the 1st, 45, which is just before the end of the war
yes.
in northern Europe. And then I went straight over for a swan, as we used to call it, and drove into Klagenfurt in Lower Austria and met Peter Wilkinson there.
Before we come to that, I'd just like to ask you, if I may, how your time was occupied when you weren't at the San Carlo and elsewhere, how your time was occupied between the early part of 44 and the early part of 45?
Well, basically organizing movement north and particularly looking after the ports.
In the south?
Yeah.
So you Naples. Stayed in the south?
Yes.
Right.
Well, no, I was at Caserta the whole time.
Oh, I see.
Really, yeah.
But if you like, responsible for the ports, but from HQ.
That's right, yep. That's right, yeah.
Okay. We then come towards the end of the war, and you decide to go on this agreeable drive, a swan. Can you describe that for me, please?
Well, it was wonderful, really, because, as I say, the Italians... The Germans in Italy had surrendered, and Jack Profumo, whom I knew at that time, it was he who flew the British general to negotiate the surrender of the Italian of the Germans in Italy with Kesselring. They met in Switzerland. He flew from Florence to Switzerland.
So Kesselring met the British representative on neutral territory.
Yes.
To negotiate the surrender of the German forces south of the Alps, really,
yes,
I suppose.
Yes, well, it was because you never knew if it was German-held territory, if he'd be, you know, the Profumo might have been put in jail or shot or anything. And then, the day it ended, I went over, and everywhere my jeep passed, you know, the Italians would come out roaring with pleasure and waving flags. And I went up the Tagliamento Valley and for the first time saw green meadows for 2 years into Lower Austria, Klagenfurt, where I met a British Special Forces officer who had been with the partisans, Tito's partisans. And I met him again later. It turned out to be Peter Wilkinson, who became a very close friend and was aide-de-camp to Colin Gubbins in SOE and wrote a very good book about Gubbins. I think with Gubbins, maybe.
Now,
no, about
was
him.
He was the commander of SOE, wasn't he? Really?
Gubbins was the commander, yes, yeah. That's right. And I knew him very well after the war, but not during the war.
Yes. Leo Marx and his book was extremely complimentary of Gubbins and the extraordinary... not only intellectual force, but just sheer force of personality.
Oh, he was an amazing man, actually, yes. And I liked him very much indeed. And I mean, the only people I kept in touch with after the war, as I say, were Special Forces, and they were mainly SAS, SBS, but also sometimes some particular people just in SOE.
Returning to your Klagenfurt journey, I know that you have described that there were German troops milling around in every direction.
They were marching home.
Oh, were they?
Yes, it was over, you see, so...
And they were allowed to go home?
Oh, well, we couldn't stop them. We hadn't any troops there. We'd no troops at that time. I mean, our troops were only just going into the Po Valley and, you know, Venice and so on. And we had... I think we had a battalion, that was all, in the Klagenfurt area, because we had to impose a town, a sort of local military mayor of the town. And it was an extraordinary time, because the Hungarians were retreating from the Russians into Klagenfurt from the east. The Chetniks were retreating from the partisans from the south, and of course the Germans were retreating from us. But the Germans by that time had started walking home because it was over, and the ditches were full of their guns and heavy equipment, because of course they wanted to walk and get home as fast as they possibly could.
Yes. When we did have the forces available, was that were they stopped? Were they prevented? Or
no. Frankly, it would have been too much of a bother. And Nigel Nicholson, who's a very close friend, who died just a week or two ago, he was in Klagenfurt when we Toby Lowe agreed, under pressure from Whitehall, to send the Cossacks back against who'd fought with the partisans Yes, no fault with the Germans, that's right, back to Russia. And it became a tremendous issue in Britain, if you remember when that happened.
And then there was a great court case that...
that's right.
Nikolai Tolstoy decided he wasn't going to pay the libel damages.
That's right, yes.
It was,
Nikolai Tolstoy, it was, who was a great friend of Nigel's, and he accused Aldington of treachery, and Aldington was simply carrying out his orders, that was all.
Yes.
Toby Lowe, his name was at that time.
Now deceased. Yes. Lord Healy, thank you very much. We've got now to the summer of 45. I think you already had political aspirations, didn't you? Can you tell me, you guide me through the final six months or so?
That's what it was. There was a by-election at Pudsey and Otley. A by-election it was. No, wait a second. No, it was a general election, that's right. No, it was a general election of 45, and they hadn't got a candidate, and they wanted... and I was invited by somebody there who'd known me.
May I ask why? You must have done something to make yourself...
Well, I was at the head of the Labour Club at Oxford, you see, and I was very active in the Labour Party when I was home. And they asked, if I'd be a candidate, and Reggie Fellows, who was my brigadier, was very nice and invented an excuse for me to come back to Britain for the selection conference to deliver a history of the Italian campaign to the War Office. So I flew back and was adopted as candidate there. And also attended in my uniform the July conference of the Labour Party and fought the election and lost very narrowly. And then, of course, I had to go back to Italy, and they had this terrible system because it was very, very slow getting demobbed. You had lie up and lie lop and all these weird things, leave in lieu of... I forget what they all were. And I had to go back to Italy to Caserta, which was a total waste of time, of course, although it gave me a chance to go again to the Ofra. I finally came home. That's right. No, I got a release because I'd been awarded... a sort of fellowship at Merton College just before I went into the army, and I never took it up. But for that reason, I was allowed to go back. But when I got back, I found they were trying to pick a international secretary at Transport House of the Labour Party. And so I went to that and was appointed to that, and that gave me an early release. I finally got out, got married, and left the army all in the week before Christmas 45. And then I started a few weeks later, 6 years at Transport House, travelling all over Eastern Europe and Japan, Russia. Fascinating job.
And you eventually joined the House of Commons in either 50
52.
So you didn't get in either of the two elections?
Well, 45, it was a safe Tory seat, Pudsey and Otley. Now it's Ripon, it's called. It's still a safe, I think it's safe Tory seat. But, so I went back, and then I stood for Leeds East in 52 and got that, and then I had 40 years in the Commons until 92, and then I went to the Home of the Living Dead, which I still inhabit.
Lord Healy, before we finish, is there any point that you feel that I have not touched on that you would like to? And if you want a moment to think, I'm happy to stop the tape.
What was a great pleasure for me after the war, just before I went into Parliament, was my wife and I were having a holiday in no, what's the place? Portofino, in a little peninsula east of Genoa. And I met some of the partisans who'd fought with us during the war, and they took me up into the mountains and showed me where they'd been. But the best book about all that, the book's on the Italian campaign, are by Norman Lewis.
Yes.
Which I think
the travel writer.
Yes, that's right. He wrote one about his time in... He was an intelligence officer in southern Italy, and he's written a very good book about that. And then he wrote Love and War in the Apennines, which is also very good, because he was captured later in the war and then escaped and had to go over the Apennines like everybody else, and before he could get to the British.
I'll look out those two volumes. They're new to me. Well, Lord Healy, thank you very, very much indeed for your contribution this morning.
Efcaristo poli. I mean, merci bien. I mean, mille grazie, sì. Come no.
Thank you very, very much.
Bye, too.